So, just a quick little bit of information. This episode was recorded at my house, and because my setup is not at all like how Allison has it set up in our quote-unquote studio, I apologize in advance. Totally 100% my fault because it's my house. If this episode has any weird sound blips.
I mean, my house has road work going on outside, so I think your house is better than that.
Fair. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Wench Bench, where friends sit and talk about fabulous fictional females and how their stories have influenced us throughout our lives. My name is Fonda.
And my name is Allison.
Today, Allison is going to be talking about Furiosa.
Yes. So I'm not only going to be talking about Furiosa today, I'm also going to be touching in on both the Wives and the Vuvellini as well. Because...
Wait, Vuvellini?
The Vuvellini. So that's actually the name of the older women that they run into from the green space.
Okay, because for a second, it does sound like a pasta dish. I'm not going to lie.
It does. It does. It sounds like other things, too, and that's intentional. And we'll talk about it.
Ooh, great!
So mostly today, I'm going to be talking about the different female characters and the feminism involved with the movie Mad Max Fury Road.
Oh, that was a good movie.
Wasn't it, though?
I really enjoyed it.
Mad Max Fury Road is one of my all-time favorite movies. Up there, right with, like, Jurassic Park.
Oh!
It is easily my favorite movie, like, of the decade as well. So you're going to be getting a lot of Allison nerding out over film craft and, like, the idea of themes and the importance of understanding what kind of story you want to tell and how important it is to start that way. And then when you carry it through, you really see what kind of art you can make.
Mm-hmm.
For those of you who don't know, Mad Max Fury Road is a film that was directed by George Miller and released in May of 2015.
Oh my god, 5 years ago?
Yeah, I know, right?
Oh, fuck. Okay.
Just blew Fonda's mind.
I thought it wasn't that long ago.
I know. It seems so new, but it's like, I see it on TV and stuff all the time, and I'm like, is this really old enough to be on, like, random reruns on, like, the History Channel? Apparently it is. So it was released to critical acclaim, scoring a 97% on Rotten Tomatoes, which it still holds today.
Is that by critics or fans?
So it's a 97% on the tomato meter, which means that is, like, the critics.
Okay.
I guess. And okay. Then it's 85% for the audience score.
Hey, that's still good. Like, that's still close to one another.
Yeah, still super high. It was also the second most nominated film in the 88th Academy Awards after The Revenant.
I've never seen The Revenant.
Me neither. I heard a lot of weird
rumors. Is that the one that has
the bear?
The bear that's
and
ripping
Leo?
Up. Yeah, is that The Revenant?
Yep.
Okay, I know why I haven't seen it.
Yeah. But it ended up winning 6 Oscars and so many other awards and nominations that season. It's absolutely wild that an action movie did that. Another reason why I'm going to be talking a lot about the movie and the creation of it is that a lot of times when you talk about action movie heroines, so much of what happens to them is what shapes why it is that they are good female characters. It's because of the situations that they're in, and...
Okay.
So, it's going to be kind of reminiscent of the whole, like, Aliens episode that Nick and I did, where we talk a little bit about how the themes really feed into the feminism.
Gotcha.
I'm going to start with a little movie recap for everybody.
I would love if the movie recap was just you being like, go fucking watch it.
Go fucking watch it. Basically, there is so much that you cannot portray about this movie. Over 90% of it is done in practical effects. And when you think about what this movie is about, which is a bunch of souped up cars driving through the desert, that is fucking wild. Oh, it's insane. It's a beautiful movie. Just go watch it. So, movie recap. Years after the collapse of civilization, the tyrannical Immortan Joe enslaves apocalypse survivors inside the desert fortress, the Citadel, when the warrior Imperator Furiosa, played by Charlize Theron, leads the despot's five wives in a daring escape. She forges an alliance with Max Rockatansky, played by Tom Hardy, a loner and former captive. Fortified in the massive armored truck, the War Rig, they try to outrun the ruthless warlord and his henchmen in a deadly high-speed chase through the wasteland.
Oh boy.
Yeah. So
through the cool. wasteland.
Through the wasteland. So basically, this movie is a high-octane thrill ride. There are so many practical effects and explosions. The score is amazing. There are tricked-out cars and beautiful maidens and an evil warlords and everything you could want from a movie.
Everything, Allison.
Everything.
I mean, I think it's missing Hugh Jackman, but that's just my personal... just my personal... comment on that one.
That's fair.
It would have everything to me if it had Hugh Jackman. And maybe some, you know, other stuff too, but that's my personal tastes.
Okay, everything you could want from an action movie. How's that?
Okay.
It's truly a movie you have to see to believe. This film was mostly storyboard. So there wasn't even really a script for this movie because there's so little actual dialogue. So much of it is portrayed through the way that they film it and the way that the actors physically hold themselves and like eye contact and like facial, small little like facial movements. It's really fascinating when you watch it again and you just focus on the skill that these actors are bringing and just how hard it must have been to portray all of these emotions without being able to say anything. It's crazy.
That just shows good acting, though. You know, as that old saying goes, actions speak louder than words.
Exactly. I also really wanted to talk about this movie because it is an incredible action movie in itself. But then you take into the fact that it won all of these critical awards, and then it also brought a strongly feminist message to a movie genre that is not known for that, and still did so well. It's a feat of, like, epic proportions when you consider the kind of people who usually watch Mad Max films, which is, like, car guys who want to watch car chases and crashes, not people who want to talk about toxic masculinity and abuse survivors. Like, it's wild. So, without further ado, we are going to get into talking about Furiosa.
Okay, thank you. I've been waiting.
Yes. So, we're going to start with Furiosa, then we're going to hop onto the wives, then we're going to hop onto the Vuvellini, then we're going to talk about a couple, I think, very pivotal points in the movie that are the most interesting to talk about.
Are they pivotal for these characters specifically, or are they pivotal for the plot of the movie?
It's mostly for the characters, but
okay.
The plot kind of follows them, and so they're pivotal for the theme of the movie, I guess.
Okay, I just wanted to understand, because this is an action movie, so I was like, are these your favorite action scenes, Allison?
Well, my favorite action scenes is the whole movie. It's literally, the movie does not stop moving. When you watch it and, like, think about that, you really notice, like, there are very rare points when they're not literally in a car moving. There's like a couple scenes, but usually they're always like running around and you never really get a chance to like pause because it's constantly in motion. And so like the whole movie is one giant action sequence.
Got it.
So Furiosa is played by Charlize Theron, as I mentioned. She is the co-main character of this movie, and she's a strong yet vulnerable and determined and stubborn and so very broken female character. But she seems to be broken in a way that, like, made something new, like crushing coal to make diamonds. Like, she didn't allow her circumstances to destroy her. It sharpened her and made her something different.
On that topic of, you said, broken but made into something new, there's this Japanese art of precious scars. Like, you've probably seen it. It's called kintsugi, where basically pottery was broken but you use gold or other metals to put the pieces back together.
Oh.
And so, like, I'm showing Allison a quick picture, because you've probably seen it, but it's where they use the scars
pottery
to make something really cool and still, like, wonderful, not only just to look at, but it's still, like, it's not useless because it's not broken,
yeah.
Right? Like, you can fix something.
Yeah.
So when you said she was broken but made into something, it just made me think of this.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a really pretty way to think about it. Furiosa was originally part of the Vuvellini, who are a group of nomadic women. And she was taken when she was a child along with her mother, but her mother died a few days after they were taken. And so she was a child brought into this place called the Citadel. She was originally brought there, it is assumed, to be one of Immortan Joe's wives. This comes out a little bit more in the extended universe stuff, but turns out that she was barren, and so he kind of just, like, threw her out, essentially. And she was taken in by one of the other people within the Citadel, and he taught her how to work on cars and how to drive and all this stuff. And so she then used that as an opportunity to become something different. And then she eventually uses that as a way to get back at the man who essentially destroyed her life by stealing his wife's.
Is it early on in that part where she loses her arm? Because in the movie, she just doesn't. Like, she's missing an arm, and she has a robotic one.
They don't really explain it.
Okay.
Which I think is fine.
Just curious if he was the reason, and that would be more of, like, a thing where she would want to go against him, or if it was just like, this happened, we're not going to touch on it.
Yeah, I don't particularly remember them touching on it, and in my research I didn't particularly come across it either. But Immortan Joe's just kind of a monster in general, and, like, the perfect metaphor for toxic masculinity.
Can you, because I'm sure there might be some people who know or some people who might not know, because toxic masculinity can get thrown around a lot in cases where some people are using it as an argument point or some people are using it for cancel culture.
Yes.
So can you, do you mind for our listeners, and again, this is from your point of view because we're not experts on this, could you explain why he is a toxic masculine character specifically?
So, first of all, he considers women to be objects. They are either essentially below his notice. So the people, the apocalypse survivors who he essentially rules over, or they are what is known as milkers, which is women who have had children in the past who are used as essentially cattle. And they actually have them hooked up to pumps and stuff because water is such a rare resource. So they drink mother's milk instead to get extra nutrients. Or there are his wives, who are his breeders, as they are called by Immortan and his followers. So that's problematic issue number one.
Yes, okay.
And then he also uses his power and his influence to create a culture beneath him within the war boys that make them want to make him proud. And he says that any weaknesses, so any things like emotions, feelings, anything that could possibly be considered a weakness in an apocalypse scenario, he shuns that and he shames you for it. As if you are not willing to die for him, you should not be alive. But they consider him his god somehow because he, like, controls their water, he controls their food, he controls everything about their lives. And he just cultivates this situation where, again, women are treated as objects and men are treated as cannon fodder. And it's altogether not a great place.
Okay. Thank you. I just thought it would be good to quickly touch on that because I agree I don't like him. He really grosses me out.
He's so creepy.
And he makes me uncomfortable. And so I thought it would just be a good moment to kind of, like, touch on why it is that you, and since we probably will talk about him again because he is the villain.
Yes.
View him as a example of toxic masculinity.
Yes. So that's why. So Furiosa eventually rises through the ranks, and she gets to be in charge of her own war rig, which is essentially a semi-truck tricked out to the maximum level. There's, like, spikes and stuff everywhere. It's super cool. and she has to do a run for materials or whatever, and she ends up sneaking out the wives who come with her because she was charged with protecting them, and throughout trying to protect them, she ended up getting to know them, and she ended up realizing that these women, even though they are treated better than everybody else pretty much in this scenario, because they get fresh food, they get fresh water, they get clean clothes, they get to be sheltered, but they also have to put up with regular physical and sexual abuse. So in a world where everybody's
probably emotional.
Oh yes.
True.
Yeah. Just so like much.
I can only imagine.
Yeah. So in a world where everybody is struggling to survive, you can like understand kind of where she came from. But then once she got to know them and she realized what was actually happening, they kind of won her over with their spirit and their attitudes and who they are as people. And I think that that's a really beautiful kind of connection that they formed together. But a lot of that isn't actually shown in the movie, which I think is something that the movie does extremely well, because dealing with these kinds of topics, you're walking on like such delicate glass, and they handled it in such a beautiful way that they never had to actually show the abuse. They never were like, look at what these women are going through. They showed you the after effects. They showed you the women who are surviving and who are strong and who are taking an opportunity to escape a bad situation, and they are putting them in the spotlight and showing how much courage it takes to leave a situation like that. And yeah, not showing it was amazing. And I think that was kind of one of the issues with the Furiosa comic, is that they really did focus on the abuse when that's not necessarily what George Miller wanted to focus on. He wanted to focus on their spirit and the importance of women, not on the tragedy that was done to them. So this is going to be a bit of a heavier episode. Sorry about it. But it's such an important and well-done movie that I do think that more people should consume it in a more, like, I don't want to use the term woke, but they should consume it with more of an open mind, looking at the actual themes, not just what it is on the surface.
Which is a really great action movie.
Which is an amazing action movie.
But that's okay, too, if you only like it for that.
Exactly. Like,
that's fine.
It's fine. But if you're interested to look into it more, there's definitely a lot of good, like, conversations and stuff that you can have in regards to this movie. What Charlize Theron does really well in regards to playing Furiosa is she...
I love Charlize Theron.
She's fucking perfection. She's such an incredible role model. Like, there's so many cute, like, videos of little girls being okay to, like, shave their heads because they got to see Furiosa, and, like, ugh, it's so cute. But she does such a good job at showing a woman restraining herself, because I don't ever see Furiosa as being a cold, emotionless character. I see her as being somebody who puts on a mask because she cannot show emotion. She cannot show weakness in this world. And so when you see her dealing with situations, it seems like she has this cool, calm head because that's how she's speaking and that's how she's acting. But then you can see on her face that, like, fury and that anger and that desperation, like, just under the surface. And they do a lot of close-up shots on their faces, and it really helps you understand her control and just how much she had to do to survive in this world. Because that's really what she is, and she is a perfect companion to Max, because Max is the same. And as a little side tangent, where Immortan Joe was like a metaphor for toxic masculinity, I believe that Max is a good example of healthy masculinity, because he is physically strong, he's all of those normal traits that you would normally apply to a man, in air quotes. He's protective. He cares about the wives once he gets to know them. He's loyal. He's all of those things that Immortan Joe isn't. And so I like that he is there as not only a foil to Furiosa, but also as a foil to Immortan Joe.
I love character foils.
Me too. And just like Furiosa, he's lost everything to this apocalypse, to this world.
And he does nothing but survive. And so that's exactly what Furiosa does. But the two of them in each other find loyalty and a connection to people that I don't think that they've ever really had before. And it's cool because it's not necessarily romantic. They just have...
It's like a platonic sort of thing.
Yeah. Like, they have a connection and they understand one another. And they never... I don't think that they ever realized how important that was until they met each other. And then you see them kind of soften a little bit to those around them because they have somebody that they can rely on and know that they can trust. And I think that their relationship, too, was made stronger because this movie was filmed over the course of 8 months in a desert. Like, all of these actors, all of the workers on the film, everybody had to essentially live out in the desert with nobody but each other and, like, heightened emotions, super long days. It's, like, winter in the desert, so it's sandy but cold. And, like, just, like, the worst possible environment, but it bred this, like, connection, but also animosity. And so apparently Tom Hardy and Charlize Theron would sometimes like not be able to shut that off between takes. And so they'd be like really shitty with each other. But like they both understood it. And then it actually ended up helping in the scenes. Like there's one particular fight scene where Furiosa actually doesn't have her arm on at the moment. And Max shows up and he's chained through a car door to Nux, one of the war boys from the Citadel, and they're having this like incredibly choreographed fight scene, and you just see like the absolute rage and anger on Charlize's face, and it's like some of that's real. Tom Hardy is actually incredibly supportive about this film being called feminist, and he also does really well at essentially taking a back seat as far as the story is concerned, because this story isn't really Max's. It's Furiosa's, and it's the wives. The trust and the relationship built up between Max and Furiosa is really highlighted when, at one point, they're being chased by another rig that's from Bullet Town. And they have a spotlight on it, and so they need to use this big gun that only has a couple bullets left.
Ah, yes. The big weapon that can only be used once or twice.
Yes, exactly. The MacGuffin weapon. And so Max misses, I think it's twice. And then there's only one bullet left. And rather than trying again, he just hands it to her. Like, there's not really any conversation. The majority of Tom Hardy's lines are like grunts in this movie. He, like, doesn't speak.
Doesn't he only, like, actually have, like, under five sentences or something like that?
One of
that?
His biggest,
like,
lines is his name.
Yeah.
And that's, and his other, like, his monologue at the beginning is a voiceover, so he's not even saying it. So he just kind of hands her the weapon, and then he stands, and then he kneels there, allowing her to use him as a prop for the gun to help steady it. So, like, he trusts that she's not going to fuck up. Like, she trusts him that he's not going to move and fuck up the shot, too. And, like, it's just this beautiful moment of, like, respect. Just mutual respect. Another reason I really like Furiosa is that she is super fucking clever. So, this is shown because she has, like, guns hidden everywhere on the war rig. Like, guns and weapons all over the place. And then she also sets it up with kill switches so nobody else can take her vehicle. And she, like, plotted out this whole escape on her own without anybody finding out. And the only reason why they even got so far is because she had ingratiated herself so much with the other members within the Citadel that they trusted her to go along with her as long as they did. And when you think about all the work that she had to put in just to get to this place, it's wild. And just how much danger she was in. Because if anybody found out about this, she would 100% have been killed. When they're discussing why it is that these women would risk everything to escape, Furiosa says that the wives are looking for hope, but she's looking for redemption. And they don't get into it, but you wonder, like, what's that redemption for? Like, what did she have to do? Like, what haunts her? One of the biggest payoffs in the movie, as far as her newfound relationship with Max, is when they plan at the end of the movie, instead of going back to the Citadel, they plan to just drive across the Salt, which is the ocean, because this technically, I believe, takes place in Australia. So in order to get away from all of this violence, they're like, well, we can just drive across the ocean. And Max is like, but that's a chance. Like, you know that there is water and fresh food and, like, all of this good stuff back at the Citadel. You just have to get there first. Before Immortan Joe does. And before he catches you. And so he uses their conversation from earlier about redemption to be like, that's where you're going to find it. You're not going to find it driving for weeks into the middle of nowhere. Like, you're going to find it back there. Probably where she had to do all of those horrible things. Where she has to go back and she has to face her past. Because you can't run away from problems. Like, you have to face them and you have to fix them. And Immortan Joe is a problem. Next, we're going to talk about the wives in particular.
Okay, how many are there?
There are five wives. The first is the splendid Angharad. She is played by Rosie Huntington Whiteley. She's the one that's pregnant.
Oh, okay.
She's also kind of the leader of the group. And she is considered to be the favorite of Immortan Joe. Then there is the Dag, played by Abby Lee Kershaw. She is the one who's actually in the early stages of pregnancy by the end of the movie. You can't actually see that, but she has the long, curly, bleach blonde hair. And then we have Toast the Knowing, played by Zoe Kravitz. She actually knows a bunch about guns, which is assumed that she actually was not born and raised in the Citadel. She was actually taken from the Wastes, and she was a part of a different group for most of her life, which is how she has more practical knowledge than the rest of the wives.
Oh, okay.
And then there's Cheeto the Fragile, played by Courtney Eaton. So this is the youngest one, and she's actually the one who earlier on in the movie suggests just going back, because we find out later in the comics that she is the only one who's still a virgin, and so she hasn't had to experience the sexual abuse that the others have. And so all she's had so far is the regular food, is all, like, the good things, all the comforts that were provided to them. And so she's really still stuck in that mind frame of, like, well, they'll forgive us, and it's better than dying, which is sad.
She's hopeful that, you know, Immortan Joe is a good,
I guess,
person. Like, yeah. Which is, if you don't see mistreatment, and if you are not being mistreated.
Yeah.
In a world that's apocalyptic, and if you're being cut off from other things, I can understand how she would, in this case, be naive, I guess.
Yeah, and it's implied that she's quite young, and that the Dag, actually, in the comics, it's confirmed that at one point, when Immortan Joe discusses the interest of taking Cheeto's virginity, the Dag stands up for her and essentially, like, says that she is the only thing that Joe hasn't poisoned, and then she gets beaten for that, unfortunately. But they're all of the other wives are trying to protect her, because they see that innocence and that, like, purity in a way, that they're like, you are a good person. And we want to keep you that way.
In a way, she's not jaded, I guess.
Yeah, so they very much so want to protect her. But by the end of the movie, she ends up learning that that's no way to live, being a slave to somebody else, like, or being controlled by somebody else. And so she ends up proving herself at the end of the movie, which is really beautiful and sweet. And then lastly, we have Capable, who is the one that's has the red hair, and she ends up kind of forming a relationship with one of the war boys, Nux. And she's the one who really breaks him out of that mindset that for some reason he owes his life to Joe, even though he doesn't. And so she kind of breaks him of this almost brainwashing, and she shows him that he can do better and he is worthy. And then it's so sad, because at the end of the movie, spoilers, Nux...
It's a five-year-old movie.
It's a five-year-old movie. At the end of the movie,
Nux sacrifices himself in order for the wives to get away. And a part of their quote-unquote religion in the Citadel is that in order to go to Valhalla, your death must be honorable and it must be witnessed. And so Capable watches him die. And they have this, like, moment where they, like, look into each other's eyes and she's like, he says, like, witness me, and she watches. And I can only imagine, like, how hard that would be to be like, yeah, like, I'm going to watch this person who I formed this bond with allow himself to die. And it's just, like, beautiful that she's just so strong. And she's one of the ones that, like, truly, like, lives up to her name, which is Capable.
I can't, again, it's been a bit, and by a bit, I mean 5 years since I've seen the movie. Don't they all have chastity belts or something on them to prevent people from...
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Yes, they do. And that's actually one of the scenes that we're going to be discussing in a moment here. But I just kind of wanted to talk a little bit about the creation of the wives. So when...
Like, creation plot-wise, or do you mean creation from, like, concept of the idea for the show?
So concept.
Okay.
So the original concept for them was each wife started out being described in a single word representing that person's core value. So Aang Herod's was the favorite or the leader, kind of leaning more towards the leader. The Dag was funny. Toast the Knowing was brainy. Cheeto the Fragile was fragile. And then Capable was actually, like, seductive. So she started off as kind of, like, the sexy one, which is really awful to fucking say in given context. They actually brought in the writer and feminist Eve Ensler, known for the vaginal monologues, to consult and enhance the portrayal of the female characters, which I think is really cool, given the fact that George Miller is obviously a man. He did, well, he's like, well, like, I want to portray them better, so let's bring in somebody who knows women and is a woman. In order to build the relationship that he wanted to see on screen, he actually had the actresses all take a bunch of, like, courses together, essentially. So they'd go to, like, acting workshops and they do all of this stuff, and he made sure that they were all together, like, all the time, because that's how they would have been within the Citadel, and so you really do pick up on that a lot. So they kind of just have, like, looks at one another, and it's like there's a conversation happening, but there's no words being used, and it's very cool that he had thought far enough ahead that he's like, I want these women to build a bond. George Miller describes them as each being a different note in a melody, which I think was a very...
That's so poetic.
I know, right? It's so beautiful. And actually, one of the other interesting things that one of the wives did was Rosie Huntington Whiteley, who played Aang Herod. She actually read a lot of testimonials by women who had had babies through rape, and she found that it was very hard to do so, but she wanted to portray the experience on screen honestly. I find it very refreshing that she took her job that seriously, especially because, yet again, it's an action movie about cars in a desert. But she knew how heavy and how important those things are to portray honestly and to give your time and your emotional effort into understanding and learning about. So there isn't really a great way to segue away from that kind of more sensitive topic. So I'm just going to say that I think that what she did was very admirable. And now we're going to start talking about the Vuvalini. So, it's a funny name. Just you wait, though.
Cool.
The Vuvalini were actually originally going to be called the Vulvalini.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Because George Miller is not one for subtlety. Doesn't really say why they decided to change it, but it's quite literally, it is a group of women. And
The Vuvellini consists of a lot of older women. You can kind of tell that Furiosa was probably one of the last generations of women kind of born out of this situation, because in a world like this, a lot of people are undernourished, all of those things. So having children isn't what it is right now.
It's complicated.
Yeah, it's very complicated. The Vuvellini are a matriarchal society. They're all like these super badass women. There's one who has like a bag of seeds, which is like a very literal metaphor for women being responsible for the existence of life. Once you see it, it's impossible not to see the like blatant metaphors in this movie. But if you're not looking for it, like you can probably just like pass it by. But there's also a beautiful scene at the end where the woman who holds the seeds, so she's actually just termed the keeper of the seeds, she ends up dying in the final fight, and she passes on the seeds to the Dag, who is pregnant, and she had had a discussion with her about how afraid she was to bring in another man like Immortan Joe into this world. And then the keeper of the seeds was like, but what if it's a girl? You don't have to carry that hatred on. And so she passes her off the seeds, and it's this really like beautiful moment of being like, go plant, make this world a better place. Ah, so good.
Allison's really emotional.
It's very emotional. It's such, seriously, such a fucking good movie. And then something really simple to talk about too is the Vuvellini have like hand gestures, essentially, where they reach out and then they pull their hand into their heart. So they reach out with an open palm forward, and then they pull it back and they close their hand into a fist and put it in their heart. And when you compare that hand motion to the hand motion of the War Boys, which where they interlace their fingers, and it looks like a machine. So it's showing the two different values that these societies have. The War Boys worship the machine. They are all cogs. They live and they die on the road. And that is the best that they can reach for, is to die victorious on the Fury Road. But the Vuvellini are about interconnectedness. They are about bringing your fellow humans into your heart and being connected on a more emotional level. And it's just, it's a beautiful other little piece of symbolism in the movie that you don't really think about until somebody points it out. So now we're going to get a little bit into these movie moments that I talked about.
Okay.
So the first one is pretty short. I wanted to touch on the initial realization that the wives escaped. Furiosa has taken the war rig with the wives, and she's turned off course, and everybody's like, where's she going? And then it kind of clicks in Joe's brain, and you see him like run to this, like quite literally like a bank vault, to go to where he keeps his prize breeders, which is so cringy. And he opens it up, and their teacher, Miss Giddy, is still within the vault. And all up on the walls, there are phrases. So there are three phrases that you see, and the first one is, our babies will not be warlords. The second one is, who killed the world? And the third one is, we are not things. Each one of these phrases on its own is like so powerful, but this Miss Giddy character, like, she taught them about the history of the world. She taught them about what the world was before, back when there was things like television and equal rights and all of these things. And these women learned from that, and she couldn't escape with them. She had to be there. I can't remember exactly why she stayed behind, but she's like, no, like, I want you guys to escape. And if I can be here to help that, I will. The phrase, like, who killed the world, is something they repeat a couple times. In this movie, the men killed the world. And at the end of the movie, the women are coming back to heal it and to bring it back to life. And so it's this like blend of needing femininity as well as like masculinity, because it's like, in this world, you need violence. Like,
it's a yin and a yang situation.
Exactly. And when all you have is one side or the other, things break down and don't work. And then, of course, there's we are not things. I love that phrase, and it packs so much into four words. Very short words. Just a basic statement. And I actually have a protest sign that has We Are Not Things on it, and it has, like, the emblem from Fury Road on it, and I bring it to all, like, rallies or anything that I do for, like, feminist support, those kinds of things, because still to this day, there are places in the world and within our own societies where women are treated as objects, and it's like, we're not. We're people. We're humans. Treat us as such, please. I just think that that statement is so powerful, and it is literally spelling it out for the audience in a very short scene what the whole point of this story is, which is women are not objects. Like,
it hits home hard.
It does. And well, I guess I should say that is my belief in what this whole story is about, or one of the many things that this whole story is about, because other people might see this movie as being about other things, and that's fair.
True interpretation of any story that's fiction is vast. To think of something that a lot of people interpret differently is a Bible. I don't want to bring it to religion, but this is a point.
Yes.
A lot of people interpret context very differently, and...
Exactly. And
no, that's okay.
It also does have a lot to do with your own personal experiences.
Yeah.
So as the person that I am, that is what I read into this movie. That is one of the many things that I read into watching this movie. Somebody from a different ethnic, cultural, any kind of other background might think differently. Mm-hmm. So, yay art!
Yay!
Yeah, so that's the first scene that I thought was very vital.
It's a short one, too, you're right.
Yeah.
I remember it being, like, a quick in and out, sort of. And they don't really go back to that room again in the movie, so.
Nope. The next one is the cutting off of the chastity belts.
Okay!
Again, like, a very literal metaphor. Removing the physical item that is restraining these women. And it's, like, kind of done in, like, a weird, hazy film style. Like, when Max sees them, they're all, like, wet because they're all dirty from, like, riding in the war rigs. So they were kind of cleaning themselves off, refreshing themselves. So they're all in these, like, skimpy linen outfits. But it's not really filmed in a sexy way. It's filmed in, like, a mirage kind of way.
Okay.
So it's very kind of interesting. Because you don't really feel gross about looking at it, because there's some scenes in movies where women are wet and showering and you're just like, ugh. this is not good, but like, it was filmed in a way that's just like, yeah, they are finally experiencing like freedom. They are able to do this, and they are able to take off these shackles and reclaim their own bodies in a way.
The shackles were all made out of metal too, weren't they?
They were very, very scary, and the actresses have actually talked about it. And they have talked about just how uncomfortable actually wearing them was, because they were very heavy and they were very, like, literal. And I don't think that there's really another way to get that feeling of, like, uncomfortableness and disgust other than, like, actually having one on. And they're like, yeah, like, it makes you realize that these were a thing. They were used throughout history, and it's fucked. So it really put them in that mindset of, like, feeling the relief of taking them off, even after only had them on for a couple scenes or for however long they had to have it on before they set up the scene. It's like, but they were relieved to get it off after maybe an hour, not considering the fact that these, like, the characters would have been having to wear them, like, all the time.
Yeah.
But a very interesting scene. Again, a really short scene. Like, they keep these emotional beats and these moments of pointed metaphor very short. So if you want to ignore them, you can. Because some people don't want to think that much when they watch Mad Max.
No, and I don't fault anyone for that. Like, especially when you go into it fresh.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
I probably wouldn't pick any of that up until if I watched it a second or third time.
Yeah. Like I said, I've probably watched this at least a dozen times by now. I watch this movie a lot. So apparently what they would do, though, to kind of lift this heavy feeling while filming these scenes, specifically this one, it was cold because it was the winter. And so they'd, like, jump around and do, like, silly dances and stuff with each other.
Wait, jump around the song and jump around.
jump up and get down. So yeah, they would jump around and they would act silly and they would kind of try and like cheer one another up, which I think is a really cute like addition to the idea that it's just like, yeah, like these actresses just needed a little like mental escape, so they're like, oh, let's dance and like warm up because we're so cold and we're soaking wet and we're wearing nothing but like linen. Also cute little side fun fact, Tom Hardy, because like a lot of times their outfits would like slip or something, and so rather than like pointing it out, he'd like stare at them with like really buggy eyes and they'd like know that they should check themselves because he like didn't want to be like, oh hey, like
your nipple, your nippy's
popping out.
Yeah, because sometimes that can be a little bit, it's different, like, you know, if I have something in my teeth.
Yeah.
I would love for you to tell me if there's something in my teeth. But if I have part of my nipple slipping out, I don't really want you to say that. Like, if we're in my own home, you know, that's different. But if we're out, I'd rather either you quietly whisper it to me or look at me with deer in the headlights. And stop me from moving. Just physically stop me.
So I think that's
stare at me.
It's a very cute little tidbit.
Don't stare at me at the location.
Nope.
Just
in the eyes.
Just stare at me in the eyes. Like
uncomfortable eye contact.
Then I'll know something's wrong.
Yeah, Tom Hardy trying to be a gentleman.
And then that can be hard.
Yeah.
Especially
yeah.
if you're not like, how would you, like, what if someone fizz, I don't know, I couldn't imagine, because to me, again, I told you what I would want you to do to me.
Yeah.
But that could be different to someone else.
Yeah, and so you just blanket weird stares, weird everybody buggy eye stares in their eyes.
Everybody.
And then the last thing, which we kind of touched on, is the women returning and releasing the water at the Citadel.
I remember that scene. That was a really cool scene.
It's a beautiful scene because they get back and Furiosa's like just about dead. Like she got stabbed and like Max had to give her like a blood transfusion and like a bunch of stuff. And in order to get up into the Citadel, you have to go on this like elevator,
it's
essentially.
Like a lift kind of
it's
thing,
like a big
right?
lift. And so they drive up in a Morton Joe's war rig and they have his like body on the hood of it, just being like, your king is dead. And then they bring up Furiosa. And then that's when the crowd who knows her and who respects her and everybody up in the Citadel also knows her and respects her. And they start chanting like, let them up. And they start chanting for Furiosa and they're chanting for the return of the wives. So like literally women life bringers are coming back to bring life to the fucking people. And so then they go up into the top, the little war boys, like the they call them war pups, which is so sad. They're the first ones to kind of start like, let's let them up, like they're so excited to like see these women who are probably been nicer to them than other people. And they're like, yeah, like, let's set them up. So then they start raising them up and they're helping people up onto the platform and bringing people up. Whereas earlier at the beginning of the movie, you see people shoving off these survivors and these like people from below. And they're literally like pushing them off of this lift because they're not allowed to come up. But the women are inviting them up and they're like, come on, like, let's go get some food. Let's go get some water. And then they open up the floodgates and all the water comes down and everybody's like cheering and happy. And then Max disappears into the crowd. But the welcome of femininity and the beginnings of life being shared and brought back is just this, like, the whole movie is just one giant fucking metaphor. And then the people literally rip Joe apart, which is...
Oh. I don't remember that, fun. If I'm yeah. going to be honest.
Yeah, they, like, push his body off to, like, the masses, and then they're all like, they get their revenge, and it's such a good movie. A couple little notes about just, like, the production of the movie that I think make it very interesting to watch is George Miller told the cinematographer John Seale to keep the main actor centered in the screen so that you never had to search for her. So this is something very rarely done in movies because a lot of the times that ended up cutting off other actors, yeah. which you don't
you don't do, but because of the fast pace of the movie, you always had Furiosa in the middle. And, like, it's just, it's highlighting her. She is the story, and she is what you are following. And it's her journey that's important, which I think is really cool. And a nice subconscious way to get you to think, this is who I need to care about. Because she is literally front and center. Mm-hmm. Which is very clever. The other fun fact is that the editor of the movie is George Miller's wife, Margaret Sixel. Mm. And she actually asked him why he thought she should take on this project, since she had never edited an action film before. And Miller replied, because if a guy did it, it would look like every other action movie. And it turns out he was super right, because Sixel ended up receiving an Academy Award for Best Editing. Oh. I think, too, when you watch this movie, if you do watch, like, a lot of action movies and you are at all into sort of the film stuff, you do notice it's edited in such, like, an artful way. And there's so many, like, nuances and things to be taken from the editing of this movie that it's not, like, explosion, explosion, action, races. It's not like a fucking Transformers movie. Like, it is a movie edited to tell a story. It just so happens to also have a shit ton of explosions and car chases. Like, so it's very cool just how, like, you do get a different feeling from Fury Road than you do from, well, any other Mad Max movie and kind of any other action movie sort of within the same genre. And yeah, that's kind of overarching reasons why I love this film. But it was, at the time of its release, subject to extreme criticism from various conservatives and anti-feminist commentators who were angry that Max himself was not the primary protagonist and that the central theme revolved more around Furiosa's story of finding her tribe and leading Joe's brides to freedom. However, critics still sided with Miller and the cast, saying that Furiosa's story lent much more depth to the film, which I think is an extremely accurate judgment, that even though this film did have some people who were upset about it, I think that it is a important film that portrayed a lot of important themes in a beautiful and fun way that is just so good to watch. Like, if you have a chance to see it in black and white, too, it's actually really cool. I watched, like, the black and white version of it, which is George Miller's favorite, I guess. And it was very interesting to watch it that way.
I'll keep that in mind.
Yeah. Do you have any questions?
No, because as I thought of one, you immediately went into more conversation about it. So, no, I don't.
Pretty good at that, apparently. All right, then. So, Fonda, what are you excited about right now?
Okay, well, it's a podcast. Ooh! Actually, so I love manga more than I love anime. When I was younger, I really loved anime. Sailor Moon, Cardcaptor Sakura, Yu-Gi-Oh, Pokemon, and Yu-Gi-Oh. Like, I really liked a lot of them.
Yeah.
And I found a podcast called Getting Animated. It's a weekly show that goes over anime news and fangirling, and it's by this really cool person who, let me just, it's blanking. It's by a lady, I think that's her pronouns. It doesn't say on anything, so I'm sorry. But her name is Destiny, and she hosts it, and she goes over, like, a lot of stuff about it. And I think it's really good and cool, and I'm enjoying it.
That sounds awesome.
I have to rush my sentence because I didn't see. But yeah, so I don't know if you like it. It's just kind of cool to be up to date because anime is a lot more consumable than it used to be. So it's kind of cool that there's a podcast that this really cool lady named Destiny does. And it talks about stuff that I probably never would have found myself.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. So that's it. We're done. No, I'm joking. I have to finish this off. So
Dear listeners, you can find us wherever podcasts can be found. Please make sure to rate, subscribe if you haven't already. Comments also are super awesome. As much as we love just like rates, we also really love a good review. You can follow us on Tumblr, Twitter, and Instagram at WenchBenchPod. And if you want to reach out, you can send us an email at WenchBenchPod@gmail.com. All the art for the Wench Bench was designed by the wonderful Tessa Joyce Reakin. You can find her on Twitter at Wearvile. And thanks for listening. Talk to you soon.
Bye.